The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour, and they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the pod of thunder and rock and roll, and it's Friday, so let's turn it over to Duff McKagan and the joke of the week.
Hey, Jericho, this is Duff McKagan calling you on my friend's cell phone. I'm at the home of the Detroit Red Wings and the Detroit Pistons. There's no cell service here, so I'm calling you on a phone call thing. So, number one, I asked my gym trainer. I got a new gym trainer, and I asked him, can you get me into the splits? And he goes, well, are you flexible? And I said, well, I can't do Tuesdays. Thank you.
Wow, they just keep getting worse and worse and worse, and I wouldn't have it any other way. Thanks to Duff McKagan for sending those amazing jokes. I think these ones came from the middle of the Guns N' Roses tour when he was in Detroit. The fact that he takes a minute out of his busy schedule to make us groan is well appreciated. Thanks to Duff, and thank you to Michael Alago and his amazing rock and roll stories. And I know what you're thinking, who the is Michael Alago? Well, funny you should think that, because Michael is the subject of a new documentary called Who the F*** Is That Guy? I'm going to give you a little background, but I'm going to let Michael fill you in on all the killer details. Michael Alago is an A&R guy who worked for some of the biggest record labels back in the 80s and 90s. He's the guy who signed Metallica to the first major label deal at Elektra. He also signed White Zombie to Geffen. He signed Jason Newsted's band Flotsam and Jetsam. He recommended Jason to Metallica after Cliff Burton passed away. He also was the A&R guy for Fozzy for our first album in 2000. He's been there with Fozzy from the start. Michael also executive produced records for everyone from jazz great Nina Simone to the legendary Cyndi Lauper to Metal Church. He's got stories about all the bands, all the labels. He'll fill you in on what it means to do A&R for labels today, and that if that even exists in the changing landscape of the music business. He'll also talk about surviving full-blown AIDS. Very, very heavy story. Michael Alago is here. The movie is great. Check it out now. It's on demand. It might even be on Netflix. Who the F is Michael Alago? Who the F is Fozzy? Well, Fozzy is the band that has a top five song right now. Judas is top five on the rock radio charts in the United States. Thank you so much to all your support. I can't believe it's still growing. They think it might even make it to, might even make it higher. But top five. I mean, if you're not number one, top five is the next best thing. So thank you so much for that. I'm actually in Switzerland today doing the Judas Rising European tour. And if you live in Italy, Germany, Belgium, or Austria, you still have time to come out and rock with us. The shows so far have been great. The UK was amazing last night. We did Aschaffenburg in Germany, which is a great, great show. Lots of fun. So very, very cool stuff. If you want to come check us out, we are in Trezzo, Italy tonight, which is a Friday night. Then we are in Roncada, I think is how it's pronounced, on Saturday. Rome on Sunday. Then we go to Vienna for Wednesday. Munich on the 15th. Essen 16. Hamburg 17. Genk 18. And then that's it. We wrap it up. We got one more show December 2nd. In Springfield, Missouri, and then we are done, man. We are done for the year, and what a year it's been for Fozzy and for Judas. We're doing VIP meet and greets and pre-show mini concerts at every stop. So come join us. Go to FozzyRock.com. I had someone come up on stage and sing with me yesterday. Rich went into the crowd yesterday. We have a lot of fun at our VIP meet and greets. It's unlike any other. Go to FozzyRock.com for those VIP packages and information on how to get it, and also to buy tickets for the show. So thank you so much. We want to see you there. And Judas is still rising, but Painless is also coming up, and Painless is what we're going to play right here, right now on Talk is Jericho. Just been added to the One More Rep playlist on Spotify by the amazing Allison Hagendorf. Thanks to Allison, and thanks to you for checking us out, and thanks for listening to Painless and for checking out the Judas album. You can buy it anywhere you buy fine music: iTunes, Amazon, Best Buy, FYE, etc., etc.
Hey, this is Chris Jericho inviting you to the first ever Rock and Wrestling Rager at Sea. Picture this: rock and roll, wrestling, comedy, live podcasting, all on the open ocean from October 27th to the 31st, 2018, from Miami to Nassau. I'm bringing Hall of Fame wrestlers, some of the greatest rock and roll bands on the planet, and putting the first wrestling ring on a cruise ship ever. Don't be a stupid idiot. Make the list. Check us out at ChrisJerichoCruise.com.
Talk is hockey. Talk is Jericho.
Does this get edited?
Well, it depends. They usually just go straight through.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. You have to just, if there's something, the best edit I ever had, I guess I can say this now because he's been gone for a year and a half, but the best edit I was ever requested was when Lemmy talked to him for about an hour and a half and we had the best time and it was done. The only thing he asked me to do is, could you please edit out the part where I said I still do speed? I might get in trouble.
Oh, right. Like, that hasn't been long documented to present day.
Yeah, he
was proud of it.
Yeah.
You know, I remember being backstage at the Beacon one night, and he thought I was with one of my coworkers, Howard Thompson from Elektra. And I said, no, I'm by myself. And there was a whole, would you say, gaggle of
That's
ladies?
A great word.
Gaggle.
Gaggle, yeah.
Because he only liked the women backstage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the guys, he could give a shit who it was.
Like most rockers.
So he opens up the door, and he says, oh, bloke, come on in, Michael. So I go in, and there's this broken, large piece of glass with the longest line of something I had ever seen. And, of course, it was back in the day, and I was still indulging. And he said, you take that one side, and I'll take the other side and see who meets in the middle quicker. And, honey, we both met in the middle at the same time. We laughed our heads off, and I think we talked for the next 2 hours until the women just kept thinking, okay, these two are not going to shut up. And the union guys were like, guys, it's union. You got to pack up right now.
It's like a decadent version of the Lady and the Tramp with the noodle. They're both eating the spaghetti
That's
at the same
right.
time.
Whoopee. A little different, but yes, similar.
I'm here with Michael Alago, who is actually a very old friend of mine. And I actually want to hear the story about that because I don't know if you know this. With the way that Fozzy started and the whole thing behind, we now have a number one song on Octane for the last 4 weeks called Judas. So you were with us at the start.
That's right.
And we'll get all into this, but you have been around since the early 80s, and you mm-hmm. guy that helped sign Metallica, and I want to get through all that. The documentary they just made about you, Who the F is That Guy?
Oh, we don't say the F
Well, we can if it slips out.
It's
going to get beeped anyway.
Right,
so,
okay. Same thing with Lars's podcast.
There you go, yeah. There were
lots of beeps.
I'll say it once just for who the f*** is that guy? The
Fabulous Journey of Michael Alago.
But until we do, I want to know, what's the story? How did you get involved with Fozzy? Because I remember you back right off the start.
Yeah. So at some point, I started working at Palm Pictures. Mm-hmm. I was making a record with Speed Dealer from Dallas, and Jason Newsted was producing them. I was also making a record with Local H from Chicago, and Jack Douglas was producing them. And then there was a gentleman who ran our office named Faisal. He at that
Faisal
point.
Faisal Durrani.
That's right.
Right.
He knew that I knew Johnny Z and Marsha. We had a long history since around 1983. And he said, we're signing this group called Fozzy. And I was like, you're kidding. I love Chris Jericho, and I've been to see him many times. And we met like 100 years ago because I sent you that picture recently.
Right.
And that picture has to be 16, 17 years old.
Yeah.
So I guess it's either – when did the first Fozzy record come out?
It was 2000.
2000.
Yeah, 2000.
So I had just started at Palm Pictures, and I became your A&R guy.
Because Fozzy, we signed with Megaforce, but
That's
they were
right.
doing some kind of a joint promotion with Palm or joint.
That's right.
Joint
venture.
Venture. Yeah,
yes,
exactly.
That's right.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So what? Because here's the funny thing about that, and you know how that whole thing started. We were just fooling around, and mm-hmm. Rich had a cover band called Fozzy Osbourne.
Right.
Local musicians would jam.
Mm-hmm.
I came and sang with them one time, and there was like a record. I'm not going to say a bidding war, but like interest from record labels mm-hmm. because Chris from the WWE and Rich from Stuck Mojo were forming a band together. And then we came up with the idea of making it more of like a Blues Brothers, Spinal Tap, Traveling Wilburys, alter ego thing. And Johnny Z, here's what the leader said, are you ready to become the next Metallica? And we're like, dude, I mean, we're playing covers. How can we be the next
right.
Metallica? But there was a lot of
we
steam
love his
on
spirit.
This in the beginning, right? Yeah. But how do you market a cover band like the original Steel Panther?
Mm-hmm.
That's basically what we were.
Well, I mean, I think it was just more than being a cover band. You were worldwide known through WWE back then?
I think it was E, maybe F, but same thing. We know.
E-F.
Yeah, E-F.
Right. And, you know, there's always ways to, you know, market any type of band if you're smart. You know, there are videos, and we had that long-form video. I don't even know if it ever came out.
It was on MTV a couple times. It
like came, late at night?
People saw it, and then it became like a little bit of an underground classic.
Right.
It's on YouTube now. Zach Wilde's favorite movie.
Get out.
Yeah, it's on YouTube.
The entire thing?
Yeah.
I never even knew that.
Yeah, Fozzie, Unleashed, Uncensored, Unknown.
Oh, I'm running.
Which was
I'm running home after this.
The mockumentary that
right,
we filmed
mockumentary.
About the band.
We did. So I guess everybody just kind of did their best in promoting it to all different areas, whether it's, you know, rock and roll or sports. And then because of you and who you were then and are now, it just it became like the talk of the town for a while.
So unbelievable. I remember, and this is just to show you how the record industry was at the time, and you can tell me how it was even 20 years prior.
Mm-hmm.
But we got offered, I believe it was $75,000 from Palm mm-hmm. Records, owned by Chris Blackwell.
That's correct.
Signed U2 and everybody else. It used to be Island. So $75,000 for an unheard, unseen mm-hmm. band.
That's right.
That's insane when you think about that.
Well, but still in 2000, people were paying that kind of money. And that really is not a lot of money
mm-hmm.
when you think about it.
Compared to now.
You get nothing.
Right. You're paying money.
I just got my friend John Joseph from the Cro-Mags, a record deal with Brian Slagle's Metal Blade.
Sure.
He has a new band called Blood Clot. And prior to that, somebody, an indie label, said, oh, Michael, I'll give you $10,000.
And there you go.
Yeah.
And you have to make the record out of that.
You have to do everything. Yeah. I said, thank you, but no thank you. Then I went to another label, and they said, we'll give you $20,000.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh, God, guys, I love you, but these aren't teenagers. These are guys, you know, and up in age a bit, and, you know, we need some money. So then I went to Brian Slagle, and I said, Brian, listen, I love you. I know you love me. So this is what I want. And he said, You have to be out of your mind, because I asked him for $100,000, right, for a punk band that we have no idea if they're going to sell.
Yeah. Five copies or
5,000 copies, right. Maybe 10,000 copies. Mm-hmm. I have no idea. So we didn't get the 100, but we got close.
Wow.
Five figures
nice.
Up there. And he was very generous, and I said, please, and I said, thank you. And we got to make the record. Everybody got a bit of advance, and the record came out maybe, I think, July 25th, and the guys are on the road right now, and I have no idea where this is going.
No, but where it's going is this, and this is a great segue, is that you have this – if Michael Alago is calling, mm-hmm. that's why they're entertaining even this $100,000 offer figuratively, because you have a track record
yes.
that is – I'm not going to say second to none, but it is up there with one of the greatest track records of all time. Not only the bands that you discovered, but the bands that you've worked with.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about the documentary they made on you.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking Metallica. We're talking Cyndi Lauper.
I executive produced her last two albums.
Uh-huh. We're talking Rob Zombie. And the Metal Church guys are involved.
There's well, you know what? There's so many people.
Right.
There is Metallica, Metal Church, Flotsam and Jetsam. I executive produced Dawkins' Beast from the East Live in Japan record. In recent years, 2009, 2010, I executive produced Cyndi Lauper, her dance record called Bring It to the Brink. And then we made a record called Memphis Blues. She called me up one day and said, you know, Michael, I know you know how to make Metallica records, but you know how to make a blues album? I said, Sin, did you ever make a blues album? She said, no. I said, good. We're on even ground here. And you know, all we did was we sat in her kitchen for weeks on end and went through blues anthologies and, you know, songs that would feel right coming from a woman's point of view. And I found her a young producer named Scott Bomar in Memphis, and he was connected to everybody, like 40-year-old guy. He was in touch with everyone from Johnny Lang to everyone in Isaac Hayes' band, Al Green's band. So we had like the creme de la creme musicians. So we went down there, and we killed it. And the record got nominated for a Best Contemporary Blues Album in 2010. Didn't win, but like they say, oh, it's always nice to be nominated. But I wanted that.
You wanted that trophy.
Trophy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I kind of covered the waterfront with all types of artists, whether it was Fozzie, Cyndi Lauper, Nina Simone before she passed away, White Zombie. I just, you know, the funny part is that I was never not confined, but I was never restricted to one kind of music. Mm-hmm. Because growing up, you know, I watched all these great rock and roll shows on TV, whether it was Dick Clark's American Bandstand, Don Cornelius' Soul Train, Don Kirshner's Rock Concert, and they all had such an array of artists, whether it's Grand Funk Railroad, Aretha Franklin, Alice Cooper, Todd Rundgren, Lou Reed. I mean, all that stuff I was listening to as a young kid. And growing up in Brooklyn, I loved AM radio. And AM radio, back in the 70s, was not formatted like it is now. Like, nowadays, you hear the same 20 songs 10 times a
yeah,
day.
Yeah, totally, yeah.
And back then, on AM radio, we had this radio station called 77 WABC. And this one disc jockey named Dan Ingram, if he loved a song, he would just go, instant replay, and he'd play the song over again. And really, you could hear Aretha. You would hear Rare Earth's I Just Want to Celebrate. You'd hear Archie Bell and the Drells. You'd hear Grand Funk. You'd hear Paul Simon. You'd hear this array of artistry, and all of that informed my listening. So once I became an A&R guy in 1983, I was hip to a lot of music, and I never wanted to be that person that only signed heavy metal. So,
well, that would put you in a kind of a box. We were talking about like.
Well, I wouldn't have mind that box, but that wasn't who I was.
Well, it's like a Clive Davis. So you're finding artists from everywhere,
absolutely,
to bring them to the masses.
Yes,
you know, and one of the reasons that I love the documentary is your relationship with Metallica at that time frame. And now you had started out. You mentioned you talk about the times you spent at CBGB's and hanging on the scene. You were that guy that was always hanging out around the bands at the clubs, just getting to know the business. Or the people around it. Is that how you ended up becoming an A&R guy?
Well, back then I was a young 15-year-old, 16-year-old. I was running around the clubs. I have no idea, like I said in the film, why my mom let me out at night.
Yeah.
But I did well in school, and I was just out all the time. And back then, you know, they didn't card people or anything. So I was out there making friends, and I always had cameras with me, whether it was a little plastic camera in my pocket, a Kodak 110, or my Polaroid camera. Eventually, I got a 35mm camera, and I just shot pictures all the time, and that's how I became friendly with the artists, because once I shot the pictures, they always like, can I get a copy? And I would always go to the dark room, because 35mm, and print up pictures for everybody.
And that's
I was out all the time, and let's see, we could fast forward to 1980. That's a good year. I was 19 years old. I was living in New York City. I was going to the School of Visual Arts. I was also working in the East Village at a pharmacy. I say this in the film as well. I was out taking lunch one day. I saw a building that looked really beautiful. It was called Casa Galicia. It was a Spanish dance hall. Prior to that, it was a women's garment center union. And it was soon going to be opening as, I don't remember, it said video club or dance club. Now, it's 1980, and you have to remember MTV just started as well. So I walk into the building. It's a gorgeous Art Deco building, and there's a man in the balcony. And like I said, it's like the Wizard of Oz. And he says, kid, can I help you? Because we're closed. And I said, yeah, I want a job. And he was like, really? I said, yes. He said, do you have a resume? I said, I do not have a resume. I go to school. And he just thought that was kind of humorous, and he called me up to his office, and we start talking, and after a few minutes, he said, I'm hiring you. You're going to get my lunch, you're going to answer my phone, and you're going to open my mail. And I thought, wow, this 19-year-old has arrived. And you know what? I was in the music business. I was there every night. I was meeting and greeting everybody, whether it was Prince or Tina Turner or Black Flag or Glenn Danzig and the Misfits. I was there. And that's how everyone got to know me. I got to know them. And
was it a dance club that they would come in, or was it a venue?
It was a venue.
Oh, gotcha.
It was a venue.
So Prince would come to play.
Yeah, yeah. Gotcha. It was mostly a video club. We had this 25-foot screen, which was unheard of then. You know, one of the most touching evenings we had is when Yoko called up and said, you know, I made a video with John just before he passed called Walking on Thin Ice. Can we premiere it at the club? Well, this was touching and touchy, and he hadn't been gone but months. So when people got wind of that, of course, the club that night was packed. The video is extraordinary. Of course, these days you can find it on YouTube. So, like I said, there was an array of artists that worked there. And what I wanted to know was how to book that room. And Jerry taught me how to speak to booking agents at ICM and FBI and all these places. And I learned how to book this 1,500-seat room. And so that was... I was there from 1980 to 1983. I knew I wanted to move forward, and I knew that Bob Krasnow was going to restart Elektra because it was in the toilet. And I was also the first A&R person he hired, and I think he hired me also because he liked that I knew everything about music from heavy metal to the Great American Songbook. And he hired me, and the second band I signed summer of 1984 was Metallica.
Well, let's just, for people that don't know, what is an A&R?
A&R stands for Artist in Repertoire.
Right.
It's a department that listens to music. Without an A&R department, you don't have a record company. And you better be successful or else you're out of a job.
Mm-hmm. And you need to bring in some big fish.
Absolutely. Yes.
So what did you see in Metallica in 1983 when they were just basically, had Kill 'Em All come out?
Kill 'Em All had just come out. They were on an independent label called Megaforce. Mm-hmm. And I went to see them at the Stone in San Francisco because the album really moved me. It was unlike anything that I had ever heard before. And I went and I saw these young people who were wild on stage. They were wildly charismatic in my mind. And I thought, I want these people to be part of my life. So I go back to 75 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City. I have no idea what to say to anybody about them because it was that wild and that different.
It was so heavy at that point in time. No one had ever heard anything like that.
These guys were combining old school metal, thrash, punk into this one thing called Metallica. But nobody else had ever done something like that. You were either a classic metal band or a hard rock band or a heavy metal band, but all of that all still very traditional, if that's the right word. So, I don't know, months passed, and Lars called me up and said, we're coming to New York. We're going to be part of a triple act bill at Roseland with Anthrax and Raven, and will you come see us? And I was like, absolutely. So I went to Roseland, Mike Bone, a head of radio promotion, and Bob Krasnow, the chairman of Elektra, came to the show as well. I don't know if they remember anything, but that's another story for another day. I lost my mind, you know, because remember, these were artists that were performing that weren't on the radio. It was all word of mouth. It was people handing out flyers. It was people handing out cassettes, fabulous cassettes. And I've said this before, there was an electricity in the air when people knew that Metallica were coming on stage. It was the first big show in New York, and they blew everybody away. And
were they on last that night?
Nope, they were in the middle.
Who was last?
I believe Raven.
Raven
was last.
Wow.
I believe they were.
Wow.
Yes, yes.
That must have been.
I think it was Anthrax, Metallica, Raven.
Back in the day when Raven had more steam than Metallica.
They were fabulous, though.
Great band.
Incredible. I love Wacko. Yeah.
Wacko, the drums, Mark Gallagher.
Yeah, oh, the Gallagher brothers. Of course.
Absolutely.
Great people. So, you know, they blew everybody away. They blew me away. I went backstage. I locked the door, and I said, I want you people in my life. I love you, and be at Elektra tomorrow. They were at Elektra the next day at noon, got them beer, got them Chinese food, and it was almost like they never left. That's how incredible it was. And I think, you know, they respected and knew about the history of Elektra, and I think they liked that I was not this traditional A&R person. They thought, like, I guess they thought because we were the same age, or maybe I was 2 years older than them, we were all in our 20s, and they thought, oh, this crazy guy is going to be our A&R person. And they loved it, and I loved them, and as they say, the rest is history.
So when you're talking about that, and you mentioned like A&R, and it's Metallica, and it's heavy, and it's Ride the Lightning is next. Was it easy to market that band and to get them booked? Was there a wave, or did you have to ever convince people?
No, because, you know, Bob Krasnow, the chairman of Elektra, let his A&R people sink or swim. And I was going to swim. And I explained Metallica to everybody. It was mandatory at some point in time when they came back to New York. Everyone in the New York office had to go see them. I think they just, you know, they were the type of band that, you know, if you worked in music, in the music business, you understood what was going on. Now, they were still not getting played on the radio unless it was Headbangers Ball at 2 o'clock in the morning, late night metal radio. So what we decided to do was just put them out on the road because that's where they were shining. Their live show was just brilliant. So it was no nonsense. And so we gave them money to go on the road. And we
should give a lot of tour support.
Oh, tons of tour support. That's the thing I believe that broke them. And then, of course, at some point in time, we can go from 84, 85, we made Ride the Lightning. The beginning of 1986, when everyone heard Master of Puppets, they knew this was their masterpiece. And at some point, Sharon Osbourne called Q Prime and said, we want Metallica to open the Aussie tour. And that just was madness. Mm-hmm. It really catapulted them into the stratosphere. For real.
Absolutely. That took them to the mainstream.
Big time.
Because Aussie was mainstream. Aussie was doing Shot in the Dark era.
Absolutely. Fabulous. Great.
What was your what were the guys, like your relationship with the four guys in the band at the time?
Well, I have to laugh because silence on the radio. I guess I was closest to Lars because he was the mouthpiece. He was the one always talked. He was the one who always called the record company, and that's just how it was. He was the mouthpiece, and whenever he was in New York, we went out all the time. You know, it's so funny. I just did his podcast, and I said to him, are we going to tell the story when we both got either thrown out of Trash Bar or we left carrying each other out, and in the middle of McDougal Street, you pulled your pants down, and he looked at his producer and said, is that on tape? And the producer said, we've been rolling. So now you've heard this story twice, Lars, in 2 weeks. What's the question? Where are we?
Where was James at the time?
I think they were all just home doing their thing.
What I mean, like, was he shy? Was he outgoing?
Oh, James. I think James was a little afraid of me because I was so outgoing and he was not. You know, the sad part of all this is I didn't have a lot of encounters with Cliff because I was East Coast, they were West Coast. I only went out there if they were in the middle of making a record or finishing a record or doing tour dates. And so I only had a little contact with him, but he was a lovely, lovely human being. He was very funny. He loved all types of music. I always kidded him about those elephant bell bottoms he used to wear. Yeah. And he would just tell me, shut up, just get me a beer. And he was just one of the loveliest people I've ever met. So, of course, in September of 86, when they were in Europe and the bus slipped on black ice and he was killed, it was, I think, the most horrible event ever. And then in my life, because, you know, we were all in our 20s, how do you deal with the death of someone who, for them, it was their brother? For me, it was an artist or a group that I was just getting very close to because I was their point person, their A&R person.
Let me ask you this.
It was deep.
Coming from a business standpoint, not personal standpoint, fanboy standpoint.
Yes.
But from a business standpoint, when you have a band like Metallica, you know the chemistry and you know the influence that Cliff has on the sound of the band, on James, on Lars, like the wise old owl.
Oh, yes.
When he passes away, were you thinking at all like, oh, like there's no way they can continue? Like, how do you continue on without Cliff, without Bon Scott? What do you do? Were you thinking like that?
I think everybody thought like that. What are we going to do? Mm-hmm. And nobody got pressured because everyone just went home and everyone was sad. I mean, major sadness. And then at some point months later, Lars called me and said, we're going to move forward. And it was great. It was different.
Right.
And they said, who do you have for us? And I recommended two people, Phil Cavano, who was in a band called Blitzbeer at the time. And I said to him, you know, I just signed this young band from Arizona called Flotsam and Jetsam. And they have a firecracker in their band named Jason Newsted. And at the same time, Brian Slagle said the same thing.
Right.
So
that was the two trusted guys that they knew.
Yes, absolutely.
Because Slagle was a lot like you came in the ground floor with Metallica. Oh. You guys grew together.
Yeah. I believe what it was is that he had put them on a compilation album.
Yes, yeah.
You know?
Metal Massacre,
that's right. Metal Massacre. And so at that point in time, Jason went for the audition, and he got it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course, they tortured him for the first few years because, you know what, it was like they were angry that Cliff wasn't there. It was like, you're not Cliff. But he
punishing
was,
him.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and I guess when you're a young person, you don't know any better, or you haven't had that kind of sorrow or death before.
But they never really gave themselves much time to grieve.
That's right.
I remember seeing them with Jason in Winnipeg. I think it was like maybe 8 weeks after Cliff had passed away. It was early December. So you're talking.
You think it was that eight weeks?
So end of September, end of October, maybe 10 weeks. December 3rd.
I don't remember it being that close.
I have the tickets up December 3rd, 1986.
Wow. Uh-huh.
Yeah, you know.
Okay, so well, there you go.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Talk is Jericho.
Let me ask you something else about this.
Sure.
I found this very, very interesting.
Yeah.
When you talk about Metal Church now, and this is probably coming as no surprise that you're gay, but in the 80s, was that an issue being gay? Because I know talking with Rob Halford, He was saying that he had to keep it like a secret because it might hurt his heavy metal credibility. As ridiculous as that sounds in this day and age, back then, was it something you had kind of had to keep behind closed doors?
No.
Okay.
I never saw a closet in my life. I didn't care about a closet. I was not in a closet. And, you know, like somebody recently asked me, I don't know if it was from the Hollywood Reporter or Variety, how did your sexuality come into play with your artists? I thought that was a ridiculous question.
It didn't come into my
you know, I might have thought somebody was cute, but
we've had that relationship for years.
Absolutely.
It's kind of fun, you know, taking the piss out of each other.
Absolutely.
Type thing. But, yeah.
But you know, it had nothing to do with that. It had to do with my fondness for the artist and how great, whether it was you, whether it was James, how great y'all were. So that had really nothing to do with it. And, you know, the funny part is, I don't know if it was because I had the job that I had and people had to come to me for their record deal if they wanted to be on Elektra. But, you know, I never had problems with anybody. I don't think I had problems with anybody my whole life, which is a blessing.
It was cool with Metal Church with Kurt Vanderhoof, who I had no idea being a Metal Church fan. He said he was gay, and
yes,
then having you in his corner kind of gave him a little bit of solace.
Absolutely,
you know?
It did.
Yeah, yeah. But once again, Kurt could never say it because he's in Metal Church, and you can't have heavy metal was a weird place to be for that stuff. A little bit of I don't know if it's homophobic, but it was also much about, you know, half naked chicks on the cover of the albums and stuff.
Right, but I also think, you know, when you go to a heavy metal show, or at least back in the day, and they were young men there going out with their buddies, drinking up a storm, and here I come along, and all I want to do is, like, drink with them, and they know that I'm gay, and I'm like, okay, could you take your leather jacket off? And they're like, okay, why is this guy taking this? And somebody would say, oh, you know, that's Michael Alago from Elektra. And they say, sure, I'll take my leather jacket off. And I was like, yes, all right. So it's a lot of fun and games. And, you know, I think in the end, when people saw, like, this guy's really cool, none of that other stuff mattered.
Doesn't matter.
Not at all. Yeah.
My,
really.
My mentor in wrestling, his name is Pat Patterson, gay since the 50s.
Who's Pat Patterson?
He's Vince McMahon's right-hand man. He's in his 70s now. But I learned everything I know about putting together a match from Pat.
Uh-huh.
And that was never an issue, but it's just like, he's such a smart guy and so fun. But, you know, he'd always say, like, hey, you don't want me to go behind you because you might get f***ed. You know, and that sort of thing. Like, just funny shit.
But I think that also just breaks down
it
a
does.
Lot of stuff.
Sure it does, right? It's
yes.
Like it doesn't matter.
No, it doesn't.
But I want to ask you, that you talked about Metallica and you had Flotsam. Was there any band that you ever pursued or that you didn't get a chance to work with?
Oh, that's so funny. A lot of people ask me that. I'm sure there were many. You know, my mind, like my attitude about life, is very black and white. If I didn't get a band, I just forgot about them. But, you know, a band that I've always loved since day one, like Metallica, is Slayer. Mm. One of the world's greatest effing bands.
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't say the F word, did I?
I'm the one who's been saying it the whole time.
Okay, I didn't say the F word. I guess Slayer, you could say, because I've loved
them. Did you pursue them?
I think for a moment I did. And I just thought, you know what? I'm so busy with all these other bands. You just can't have everyone in your life. And you can't overload a label with almost the same kinds of artists. So I just stayed a fan all these years. You know, I love seeing Gary Holt these days. He's so wonderful.
Hilarious, man.
He's hilarious. And I've known him for, 30 years. And so I've just always been a fan, and I've always just verbally supported them. And that's
it. What about, like, so you mentioned how you're very diverse musical taste. In the 80s, you're known as being the Flotsam guy, the Metalchips guy, the Metallica guy. When did you start spreading your wings and looking for bands outside of that genre?
Well, you know, I don't even know if there were any bands that I signed that weren't metal. But then, you know, at some point, there's an artist named Michael Feinstein who played all the cabaret rooms. And he is like, he does all the Great American Songbook, all the great standards. So I made about 5 albums with him. And there was an artist who was my idol growing up. Her name was Nina Simone. And Nina Simone was arrogant, hateful, loving, beautiful, and one of a kind. She could take a Bob Dylan song, a George Harrison song, a Beatles song, and absolutely make those songs her own. And like, if you didn't know any better, you would say, wow, did this woman write these songs? Because she was pure magic. Really, she was one of these people that if you heard her, you didn't forget her. And so at some point in time, I got to make a recording with her. It was 1993, and it wound up being the last full-length recording she ever made. She died 10 years later in April 21st, 2003. I can't believe I remember that date. But she was very dear to me. You know, it's like when people talk about if you were on a desert island and you could just have like 5 albums, what would those albums be? For me, I think it would only be Nina Simone's albums. If I could hear her voice morning, noon, and night, I just love that voice. So let's see, the diversity. I guess when I went to Geffen, I signed White Zombie. I signed Kane Roberts, who played with Alice Cooper, who I adore.
Musclehead.
Watch it. I just spoke to him yesterday. He's making a new independent record that I'm kind of overseeing. Love you, Kane. I always forget I was at a label called Uni, which was, I don't know if I was so drunk those 2 years or what, but there was a noise band from New York called Swans. And if bands played on 10, Swans played on 12. It was unnerving. Mm-hmm. It was a beautiful noise that they made. And, you know, their shows would go on 12 for 2 hours. It was relentless and powerful. It was almost like going to church of sorts. And so I signed Swans to Uni, and I made the quietest record with them ever. This great bass player named Bill Laswell, who was in a band called Material, a well-respected band in New York, produced their record. They did a version of Traffic's Can't Find My Way Home on there. It's a very lush recording. And at the time, I was friends with the photographer Robert Mapplethorpe, who was dying of AIDS. And because this record was so quiet and we didn't want a band photo, I found this beautiful yellow calla lily that we decided we were going to put on the album because it just kind of spoke of the energy and the quietness and the beauty of the record. After that, the Swans never made a record that sounded like that again. And it's almost like this underground cult classic. It's called The Burning World.
You mentioned something about Robert Mapplethorpe dying of AIDS.
Yes.
In the movie, did it say that you had AIDS at some point in time?
Yes.
Right.
I had full-blown AIDS.
I had no idea.
Yeah. Maybe because, well, by the time you met me, I was up and about again.
Right.
Yeah. You know, it's a wild thing, you know. I don't even know where to begin. You know, I drank and drugged a lot. I didn't pay attention to my life. I contracted HIV at some point in time. And in 1995, I got full-blown AIDS. And everyone thought I was going to go. I was on my sofa for about 9 months, wasting away. It was awful. It was awful.
I didn't think that you could actually come back from full-blown AIDS.
You can.
Well, yeah.
In 95, they had one pill called AZT. And my doctor, who was at the forefront of medicine, said, don't take it. I mean, I'm dying on the sofa. I mean, Rob came to see me. Eric Bogosian came to see me. Cindy, everybody came to see me, and everybody thought he's a goner. But I believed in my doctor. And one day she came over before all her rounds at St. Vincent's. Now, St. Vincent's back then was – they had an AIDS ward. That's how huge this disease was at the time. And she came over to my house every morning at 5 o'clock in the morning before she did her rounds. And at one point she said, I have some pills for you. They're not FDA approved. Will you take them? And I said to her, listen, man, I'll do whatever you tell me. So these two were not FDA approved. This was FDA approved. We did a lot of intravenous medication. And 9 months later, I was up and I was back at Elektra. I was skinny, but I was up. I was working, and I never, ever got sick again. It's a miracle of science.
Absolutely.
And right this minute, in 2017, I go get my blood checked all the time, every 6 months. Can't even find a trace of it in my body. It's a miracle.
Has that ever happened? It must be a very rare thing.
Well, no, people do. If you take care of yourself, if you pay attention, if you take the medicine that is required to take, your viral load, as they call it, goes down to zero and totally undetectable. And yes, that happens a lot. Wow. But you have to pay attention.
Sure. But like you said, that's a miracle. Did that stop you from drinking and drugs?
No.
You kept rolling, huh?
I did. Listen, after I got well, I drank. I did crack. I was a madman. I was not – I don't know why. I wasn't looking to kill myself, but that's what was happening. Mm-hmm. And finally – I don't want to say only 10 years ago, but 10 years ago, I was 47 years old, and I was sick of myself. I was sick and tired of myself. I was sick of not showing up. I was sick of lying. I was sick of cheating, and I thought, I want my life back. So 10 years ago, cold turkey, I just stopped. And I don't know if it was a moment of grace. I don't know what it was, but it was a Sunday morning. It was October 21st. I don't know how I remember all these dates, 2007. And I said, you know what? Go to an AA meeting. Just go. I went 2:30 in the afternoon that day, and I never left. I still go 5 days a week. I go Monday to Friday at 9 a.m., and I feel like if that 1 hour in the morning is going to help set my head on straight, that for all the minutes and the years that I drank and drug, I'm not going to fight it. I'm just going to go. And you sit in a room with like-minded men and women, CEOs from record companies. They say, is a saying in all the 12-step meetings, Park Avenue to Park Bench. Mm-hmm. That's really the truth.
Yeah.
You know, you're shocked who you see in some of these rooms. But you know what? When you need help, you ask for help.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't be full of shame because the shame will kill you. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I'm up and about.
I had no idea about that.
Well, because, you know, I guess I didn't talk about it with people.
Right.
You know? And by the time I met you in 2000, it was already 5 years prior. So I was just – I didn't think about it.
What I
thought about was take your 5 pills in the morning and take your 5 pills at night.
Stay healthy.
And so, you know, I don't drink or drug anymore. Like I said, coming up, it's 10 years. I go to my meetings 5 days a week. I help other people who need help because all of that help was so freely given to me. And if that's what it's about, I'm going to help another person.
Yeah.
But I always help people. I love people. And
stuff. But that's one thing I said. Like, I loved watching your documentary, even if I didn't know you. And you've got some great people talking. And one of the guys who's always awesome is Rob Zombie.
Right.
He's always amazing.
Yes.
But you mentioned you found White Zombie as well. Mm-hmm. Where did you catch their vibe? Where did you see them?
A good friend of mine, Daniel Ray, who was in a band called the Masters of Reality with Chris Goss. And
wasn't Ginger Baker in that band at some point?
He did play drums. He absolutely did. Crazy, wonderful Ginger Baker.
He's got a crazy documentary. Oh, he beats the guy up. Breaks his nose.
You talk about no nonsense. So Daniel Ray, he was in Masters of Reality. He produced the Ramones. He wrote Pet Sematary for them. He played with Iggy. Said, I saw this band. You're going to flip out. So he takes me to a bar in the East Village. It wasn't even a bar. There was a restaurant, and underneath they wanted it to be a club or a bar. Right. And there was nothing in there but a stage maybe 6 inches off the ground. And they were playing in the corner, in the back, in the dark, like I say in the film. And it was wild.
Mm-hmm.
All those dreadlocks flying all over the place. Shauna, their bass player, was the most adorable thing I ever saw. She was hot on stage. And I just thought, I love these people.
Mm-hmm. Same thing. I want these people.
Love
in my
these
life.
People.
Yeah.
So when it was over, I introduced myself to Rob. And, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but he said, you know, we're going to be big and I'm going to make films. And I believed him. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'm going to sign you to Geffen Records. Mm-hmm. And I did. And, you know, there's a good funny story there that we put out the record on Geffen. The band moved to the West Coast, smart cookies that they are, because they wanted to be in the face of Geffen Records. And that's where Geffen was based, on Sunset Boulevard. So we put out the record. And at some point in time, after I've talked them up to everybody at Elect, at Geffen. I was at Geffen, I was at Elektra. That was 20 years right there. So I'm at Geffen, and the record stalls at 180,000 units. And everybody is worried. They're up in arms. What are we not doing for this record? So we poured more money in. But a funny thing happened. A little show called Beavis and Butthead. Now, remember, that show, people couldn't get enough of those
huge
crazy guys then. They decided at some point in time that White Zombie was their favorite band. And they played that first video, morning, noon, and
Thunderkiss?
Thunderkiss.
Wow.
And you know what? That helped catapult that to 1 million units.
Isn't it amazing that that show, because they did the exact opposite for Winger. It killed Winger when that guy Stewart, the nerd, was wearing a Winger shirt. And I remember the kid was
Wait,
like,
are we talking about another show now?
Beavis and Butthead.
Yeah, but who's Stewart?
Stewart was the maybe his name wasn't Stewart. It was the nerd. I think his name was Stewart. It's the nerdy guy that Beavis and Butthead used to make fun of.
Oh, yes. Okay, okay.
So as the nerd, he's wearing a Winger shirt.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and it's, I think the guys who were in Metallica Slayer,
right,
but
right,
you were
right.
You were Winger. Winger, fuck.
Oh, they were great.
That's what I mean. But like Winger's like, you know, Beavis and Butthead killed me.
No.
But that was the influence that they had.
That's right. Those two little cartoon characters.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Who were the ugliest thing you ever saw. But yes, that really helped. You never know where promotion is going to come from. You never know that one thing. And sometimes it only takes that one thing that catapults a record into the friggin' stratosphere.
Snowball it.
Absolutely.
Right. You know, the documentary, was it like when you see these guys talking about you and all these positive things, how do you feel? Like, how do you feel about having a movie made about your life?
Well, this New York director named Drew Stone approached me at some point in time. And I just thought, what does he want? And we had a couple of lunches together and a couple of good conversations. And I thought, well, he loves music as much as I love music. And then, of course, the ego takes over. And I thought, let's just do it. And he did his research about me. And, I never, even when you don't see people for a certain amount of time because, you know, Cindy does her thing, I do my thing. I never had bad interactions with people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I loved the artists that I worked with, and they obviously loved me back. And, you know, who I swear by in the movie is John Lydon.
Mm, he's right.
John, listen, man, one of the smartest people I know.
Mm-hmm.
He could be tanked, and he will talk you underneath the table, and he knows what he's talking about. And, you know, when you think about John Lydon and the Sex Pistols had one album out, revolutionary. It also changed the face of rock and roll.
Yeah.
And, you know, he does his thing, and, you know, we never sold 1 million records with him.
Was that Public Image Limited?
Public Image Limited.
Did you A&R with them?
Oh, of course. Okay. I signed John.
Oh, you signed
him. I signed John in 85,
and
we made an album called Album, and the cassette was called Cassette, and the poster was called Poster. All John's idea. And, you know, that record that Bill Aswell also produced, he did my Swans record. Steve Vai is on that record. Ginger Baker is on that record. It was all session people that John had on that record. It's a monster of
a
record.
Was it a solo album?
No, it was a
Pill album.
Everything is under the moniker Pill,
right?
But it's John.
Sure.
So we made that record. I knew that Virgin Overseas was not putting out Live in Tokyo, and a record he made called This Is What You Want, This Is What You Get. So I put those records out as well. I have no idea right now where we're going with John, except that he's brilliant, and he's great in the
movie. Yeah.
And, you know, he's so loving, and people don't know that side of him. And I guess because of the relationship that we have, for, oh my Lord, 36 years. I met him when I did a PIL show at the Ritz, and it was a disaster. It was a riot. Chairs were thrown, bottles were thrown. That $50,000 screen got torn down. It was on the 8 o'clock, it was on the 11 o'clock news, it was on morning news, it was a shot heard around the world, it was on every UK, the cover of every UK magazine, and we kind of laughed about it, but at the time it was no laughing matter, and, you know, through that, and John always kids me, because at some point in time, we had to drop him from Elektra because of his deal was so expensive that it just would have cost more to keep him, knowing that he was never going to sell those million records. But I swear by John Lydon. And, you know, to this day, he always says, you dropped me for that metal band of yours, Metallica. And we have a laugh about it. But like I said, 36 years later, we never really had a bad word. Mm-hmm. I love him. He loves me. And he's an extraordinary human being.
I was going to ask you when you talk about a pill of being basically, you know, it's Johnny Lydon with a different lineup. What did you think, like, when you talk about, like, Rob Zombie being as big as he is today? Mm-hmm. Is that magic still there? Or did Zombie, the band, have the influence? Or was it basically just Rob and a bunch of players?
White Zombie made two albums.
Right.
They were a family. Mm-hmm. They were young people living in the East Village, and they created that sound. And at that point in time, nobody really sounded like them. And at some point, Rob just didn't want to work with them anymore. And that was, you know, fine. And so really, Rob has always had that charm and charisma. And he always knew what he wanted to do. And just fronting Rob Zombie with whoever is in his band is just fine because people come to see him.
Right.
People love those wild, crazy horror films that he makes, which are great. I love The Devil's Rejects.
Yeah, for sure.
Rob is great, really.
Very talented, very smart, fun guy.
Absolutely.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed, also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
You're listening to Talk is Jericho.
Something that you know, maybe not as fun, that has changed so much over the years, and we mentioned it earlier, talking about Fozzy getting to me at the time was this big deal, and bands making 10 times the amount of that. How much has the record business changed since you got into it, pros and cons?
Oh, boy. I was very lucky as a young 24-year-old to be in the music business in 1983. I stayed an A&R person from 1983 to 2005. Long period of time to never get fired from anywhere.
right.
That's a blessing in itself. You know, back then there was a thing called artist development. And, you know, we'll use Metal Church as an example. I signed them because they made a little independent record that I think I paid $10,000 for called Metal Church. I then make a record with them with a great British producer named Mark Dodson, and we make a record called The Dark. I think that record might have sold 50, 60,000 records.
Really?
But because there was a thing called artist development, you wondered. We made a $5,000 video for a song called Watch the Children Pray. You know, that always got played in late night metal radio, Headbangers Ball, and we gave them money to go on the road. So we knew the markets that the record sold. We knew that we needed to keep them on the road. And because of artist development, our company, I don't know if policy or thoughts were, let's hope they get to 100,000 units next time. They don't do anything like, it's nothing like that anymore. Because records are so expensive to make. I think A&R people are afraid of taking a chance. I think a lot of A&R people go to YouTube and they watch new artists on YouTube. You know, for me, I find that cold and indifferent. You know, some young band could have 100,000 hits. Yeah, them and their friends sat there all night just going click, click, click. Maybe, maybe not. Maybe, maybe not. But that's so two-dimensional.
Technically, you could.
Yes, technically you could. And, you know, for me, that's so two-dimensional. You have to see someone and touch someone and smell someone and get in their face. And I want to hear your point of view. Yeah. I want to know that you're not a wallflower. I want to know that you got something to say to me. So these days, there is no artist development. I think sometimes record companies try to sell things by old templates that don't work anymore. I haven't really kept up with it because I don't need to. You know, for me these days, I just work on records if artists ask me, or I seek out artists that I've always wanted to work with to see if they want to work with some new producer. So I just work on project by project these days. But
do you produce, or what do you
well,
do?
Well, I got called executive produce. For gotcha, me, executive gotcha. Producing means I work on the material, yeah. I find the songs, I find a producer, I put a budget together, and let's go.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting when you talk about the money, because I mentioned that Metallica gig that I saw in December of 86. Yes. Wow. Metal Church was the opening band.
Oh, how great.
So that was like, you know, obviously putting them together.
They absolutely.
Get them
label mates.
Right, yeah, label mates. Which, yeah. What about, I was asking you earlier about Flotsam and Jetsam when you kind of give them the Iggy on Jason Newsted and then he goes.
Oh, yeah.
What are you thinking about Flotsam and Jetsam after? Once again, what do we do?
Right. Well, that was definitely a what do we do because Jason wrote a lot of the songs. Yeah. He was like that.
He was the leader of the band.
He was the leader of the band, although he wasn't the singer. Mm-hmm. Everyone knew about
I think he wrote most
Jason
of the material
Newsted, yeah. And he wrote most of the material. They quickly found another bass player. I'm not sure if it was Mike Gregory or who it was at the time. And, you know, good guys, great musicians. You know, nothing ever sold big. But, you know, there are people who are still worthy of making records. They recently made a record called Ugly. Honey, that record was damn good, you know? So it's like, I don't know. You sometimes don't lose that goodness, but, you know, they just never catapulted anywhere. Right, they just kind of stayed in the same place, and you love them if you love them, and not everybody makes it big. It's about timing, the right place at the right time. It's a whole host of things.
Sure.
But you know, I was happy that I signed them.
But and the thing I liked about it, too, and once again, talking about the documentary and the people that you have doing the interviews, it wasn't just like, you know, Metallica sent Lars as the representative. Because we've seen that in the Anvil movie. You know, Lars is like the spokesman. No, no, no. Lars was in it, but so was Jason. And so was Kirk. And so was James. And James is not the guy that usually does those sort of things. Mm-hmm. Did you know that you know, hey, Michael, we got Hetfield? Or, like, did you have a checklist of people that you wanted to try and reach out to? Or did the
director? Oh, for the documentary.
For the documentary, yeah.
Yeah. You know, we started with Lars, and I just said to Drew, you know, we can't just have Lars, you know. Lars is good enough, but you know what? It's Metallica. You need the front person, the mouthpiece, the spokesperson. And never mind that James is one of the greats. He really is one of the greats. And what a different animal he is these days than 1983. I mean, really, he's so grateful and loving on stage and powerful. So, yes, there was a checklist. You know, I knew I wanted John in. I wanted Cindy. I wanted one of the Misfits, and I love Doyle. So Doyle's in the movie.
Yeah. Got Rob.
And Rob Zombie, of course. And these were all people that I played an important part in their lives, and they played an important part in my life, and they saw me through a lot of stuff. So,
how rare is it that every big name that you worked with was in that documentary? There's nobody I can think of that we talked about that wasn't in it.
Except
for Nina, who passed away. She had an excuse.
She had a good excuse. But we talk about, we speak of her lovingly in the movie, and people are like, when they see the movie, they're a little wowed by that segment on her, because if you know nothing about her.
Like me, I didn't know.
Powerful. Mm-hmm. Very, very powerful. What was the question?
Just talking about, you're talking about Nina Simone.
No, but what was your... No.
I was just saying everybody big that you worked with is in the movie.
Well, you know, I think it says something about all of us that we've all stayed in touch.
Yeah.
And, you know, I loved them. They loved me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think when it was the time to kind of almost pay back, they wanted to say some nice things about me, and work experience together and our personal experiences together. As you know, you heard from John Lydon and you heard from James Hetfield and definitely Kirk Hammett, you know, and it's wonderful. Yeah. It's wonderful. Well, and, you know, Jason also says in the beginning of the movie, if it wasn't for Michael Alago, I don't know where if I've been here right now.
Yeah, yeah,
and
absolutely.
That's the truth, you know.
When's the last time you saw those guys? Face to face, besides Lars, you mentioned
I
in this podcast.
I saw Lars like about 2 weeks ago.
How long was it before you'd seen him?
Prior to that? Yeah. Oh, I just saw them do the Nassau Coliseum and the MetLife Stadium. And,
so whenever they play, you're going to
I always go. Yeah. You know, last year I saw them in Quebec because one stadium was getting torn down. They played the last show there, and one new stadium might be like the Pepsi Arena or something in Quebec City. They were opening up that stadium. So I went to both those shows. I just saw Jason last week. He's doing a lot of painting these days. And so we had a day together. We went to the Museum of Modern Art. The world-famous photographer Harry Benson shot a portrait of him. And if you don't know anything about Harry, he's Scottish. He came here in 1964. And every single early Beatles picture Harry Benson took.
Wow.
Harry Benson goes far back as one of the first portraits he ever shot. You're not going to believe this.
Who?
Winston Churchill.
Wow. He must be 90 years old.
Harry is 87.
Wow.
A lot of curse words come out of his mouth. He has no filter. He is charming. And he is world famous.
Yeah, classic.
Classic. So he shot Jason for some publication.
I got to tell you this because you'll appreciate it as a music fan. You just mentioned the early Beatles. I was at Sirius today doing promotion for the book.
Uh-huh.
And I ran into Sean Lennon. And
oh, wow.
So I was like, hey, and he was with this really tall blonde girl. And I was like, yeah, talk to him for a couple seconds. Can I take a picture. And the blonde girl was in the middle and he was on the end. Then I see the blonde girl again afterwards. And she's super friendly and super nice. We're talking about Anne Margaret. And I'm like thinking, who is this chick? It's Theodora Richards, Keith's daughter.
Oh, my God.
Then Lucas Nelson comes over, Willie's son. So it's Willie Nelson's son, John Lennon's son, and Keith Richards' daughter all hanging around with Jericho standing on the outside going, oh, yeah, cool, man. It's just like talking about rock and roll royalty. What a cool moment, you know?
Did you take a picture?
I did.
I love you.
I did. I posted it. And that Theodora, once I found out she was Keith's daughter, I was like, man, she's pretty hot. I like her.
Oh,
my God. Yeah. But as we wind down here, I just want to talk briefly about Cyndi Lauper and just how great of a singer she is.
Wow, Cindy's extraordinary. Mm. Cindy takes great care of herself. Cindy is a natural born entertainer. I don't know what to say about her except that.
How did you meet her? How did you get to work with her?
Cindy, back in the day in the 80s, when I was at the Ritz from 80 to 83, she had a band called Blue Angel. I think they were on Portrait Records, but I'm not certain. And they were playing around New York all the time. There was talk that there's this girl in Blue Angel named Cyndi Lauper. And so we booked them a few times. And then soon after that, I believe she got her deal with Epic Records. I had nothing to do with any of that back in the early days. And as we know, that first album was a monster. Girls Just Want to Have Fun worldwide. And, you know, she's kept her credibility all these years because she has stayed true to herself. And the voice is still impeccable. There was a night that she was 8 months pregnant and Tina Turner asked her to open the shows at the Garden. All of a sudden, you see this woman come out 8 months pregnant. And at one point, she comes off the stage and is walking in the audience. And people are flabbergasted. People are staring. And she's quite the show person.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's extraordinary. So after that, her manager, Lisa Barbarese, was our publicist at Elektra. She was our publicist at Geffen. Lisa and I stayed friends, and I would spend Thanksgiving with them. Cindy would always come over with her family. And so, I don't know, I guess a good 12 years ago, we kind of reunited. And like I said, in 2009 and 2010, I A&R'd two of her albums. And we've just stayed friends.
Yeah,
you know, it's lovely.
Yeah. Last question is a two-parter.
And she still looks so beautiful.
She looks great. Oh, yeah. Always had a crush on her.
Yeah. Stays out of the sun.
Yeah. Okay, top three favorite bands of all time.
Oh, no.
If you have to name them, or some of them, and top three best rock and roll shows you've ever seen, best live bands. Is that something you can even do? You're looking at me like you're having a heart attack.
First concert I ever went to, June 3rd, 1973. It's the last night of the Billion Dollar Babies tour at Madison Square Garden. My cousin's boyfriend takes me. I'm 13, about to turn 14 years old. And I had bought that album back in the day. I'll try to be as short with this as possible. Back in the day, if you had the TV guide, in the center of the TV guide, there was something called Columbia House. And you could order records for like 10 for a penny.
For a penny.
But you didn't read the fine print. You know what I mean? I ordered Alice Cooper's Killer. Now, in retrospect, I'm thinking of this, and there was censorship even then, because when I got that album, it didn't say Killer on it. If you bought it in the store, it had that child scrawl that said Killer. It didn't say Killer. And I think back then there was some form of censorship.
Sure,
like that word wasn't allowed.
Yeah.
So I see Alice Cooper, June of 73. I see Lou Reed, Summer of 84 at the Felt Forum, which was the small part of Madison Square Garden. It's where he made his live album there. Oh, gosh, let's see. Well, I guess in 83, 84, Metallica at Roseland, because it was a landmark show.
It's a
legendary gig, and it's the gig that I signed them. So I guess Alice Cooper, Lou Reed, and Metallica. Okay. Yes. And then the other question
Favorite bands.
Ay, ay, ay. Okay, in no particular order, Metallica, Black Anvil, Lou Reed, Todd Rundgren, Alice Cooper, Brian Ferry, Black Sabbath.
Nina Simone.
Swans, Judas Priest. I said Black Sabbath.
Yeah.
I don't know, the list could just go on. Slayer, for sure. I mean, you know, it's extraordinary when you could hear them as their encore for 27 minutes do Rain in Blood.
Right.
Like, that's the encore, the whole album, 27 minutes. You gotta love that stuff. So I guess that's a few of the people
that
I love.
Well, let me say this. If there's ever a guy that was deserving of a documentary that people might not have known of, there's two for me, Shep Gordon and Michael
Wong. Oh, well, you're too kind.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
And I actually sent Lars a text after I watched your documentary. I said, listen, here's something. I just watched the Illogical documentary. Here's something you might not know. Michael was instrumental at the beginning of Metallica's career and Fozzy's.
I love it.
You're kidding me.
Uh-huh.
So thank you so much for all you did for my band and for music.
First of all, you know, I haven't seen you in so long.
I know. Next time we play in New York, you got to come to our show.
I will, and I haven't seen Rich Ward, who I've always loved.
Yeah.
And he's wonderful, so you have to send my love to him.
Absolutely.
Give him a big hug for me. And,
I will.
You know, you look the same. You look so handsome, and you look so fantastic, and we can't not see each other for over.
Deal.
Ay-yi-yi.
Let's forget it.
Right.
Forget
so
it. Deal.
See
this
each
point
other.
On.
Thank
we're shaking
you.
Hands
shaking
on
hands,
it.
My friend.
Thank you, Michael.
Oh, Chris, thank you so much.
And now, Reflections with Raven.
My wife says she has European roots. Personally, I still think they're gray.
For more Reflections with Raven, listen to The Raven Effect on the Jericho Network via the Podcast One app or subscribe at Apple Podcasts. Raven's bringing the laughs to the Chris Jericho Rock and Wrestling Rager at Sea. $150 holds your cabin at ChrisJerichoCruise.com. You can be a part of it. We're setting sail October 27, 2018 from Miami. But if you book your cabin by January 15th, you still got a good 2 months to do that. You'll get a picture of me with the list. And if you book one of the first 400 cabins, there's still a few of those left, you can be a part of a special Q&A with me. And you'll be able to hang on the ship with all these incredible guests. Meet and greets, signings, rock and roll shows, live podcasts, the Ring of Honor, Sea of Honor tournament. It's all included in the price of a cabin. All inclusive. Even food, all inclusive. You don't have to pay a dime, and you get to hang out with Jim Ross, Jerry the King Lawler, Mick Foley, Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, Rey Mysterio, Killing the Town, Cyrus is going to be there, Keeping It 100, Conan Disco and Shane Helms, Beyond the Darkness, Raven, Brad Williams, Ron Funches, Jim Brewer, Busted Open Radio, on the rock and roll side of things, Fozzy, Phil Campbell and the Bastard Sons, King, The Dives featuring Evan Stanley, The Dave Spivak Project, Jim Brewer's Loud and Rowdy, The Darlings of Rock and Roll Cherry Bombs, Shoot to Thrill, the world's greatest female AC/DC cover band, Blizzard of Ozzy, the world's best Ozzy Osbourne tribute band, and of course, Ring of Honor is presenting Sea of Honor aboard the ship. Matches will be happening in the middle of the ocean, on the boat, and the winner of the Sea
of Honor tournament, gets a Ring of Honor World Heavyweight Championship shot in the future, title shot in the future. The Young Bucks will be there. The villain, Marty Scurll, will be there. Cody Rhodes will be there. More will be announced soon. The Bullet Club is going to be on board. Of course, don't forget as well, January 4th, streaming live on New Japan World, is Chris Jericho versus Kenny Omega, Alpha versus Omega, in one of the biggest dream matches of all time at the Tokyo Dome. If you haven't heard about that, go check out my Instagram at Chris Jericho Fozzy. You'll see all the details there. Before I say see ya, don't forget to go to represent.com/Fozzy. Pick up the new Fozzy shirt and help fight juvenile diabetes. And don't forget all the other great podcasts on the Jericho Network. Team Tiger Awesome. Start your week with a laugh. New episodes every Sunday morning. Killing the Town with Storm and Cyrus. This week they talk about Jericho versus Omega. Rock Talk with Mitch LaFon. Mitch getting the biggest stars in rock and roll every Monday. The Raven Effect. Nobody mixes pop culture and wrestling like Raven, except for maybe our flagship show, Keeping It 100 with Conan, Disco Inferno, and Sugar Shane Helms. They're my favorite podcasts of the week. And Beyond the Darkness, delivering the best paranormal stories and interviews every weekday, scaring the crap out of you. And they've got True Crime Tuesdays going at patreon.com as well. For $5 a month, you get a new True Crime episode every Tuesday with no commercials. So sign up now at patreon.com. And coming up on Wednesday, tying in with my big special, The Legend Of with Chris Jericho, which airs November 17th at 11 p.m. Eastern on the Travel Channel. We're going to talk to the American treasure hunters, real life archaeologists who search for treasure in America, and they find them. They helped us look for the treasure of Butch Cassidy. They found a lot of crazy stuff. Do you know how much Aztec treasures are buried in Utah? Great, great story about that. Real life archaeologists, American treasure hunters, will be here on Wednesday. We'll see you then. In the meantime, and in between time, stay hard, stay hungry, peace, love, and hugs, and a big yeah! Oh boy! Don't forget to check out Who the F is Michael Alago on demand now. You can check that out. It's a great documentary. It's worth it, and I want you to check it out. Thank you so much. We'll see you on Wednesday.